Keep It is brought to you by Audible's Project Hail Mary. It's time to believe in the Hail Mary. Project Hail Mary, one of the most beloved adventure stories by Andy Weir, is now a major motion picture, so there's never been a better time to immerse yourself in the best-selling audiobook. As the sole survivor on a desperate last-chance mission, Ryland Grace must save the Earth from disaster in this incredible science-based thriller. Fan-favorite narrator Ray Porter brings every moment to life with humor, heart, and pulse-pounding tension. Now that the blockbuster movie has finally arrived in theaters, there has never been a better time to start listening to the universally acclaimed audiobook. Part scientific mystery, part dazzling interstellar journey, Project Hail Mary is a tale of discovery, speculation, and survival. Listen to the audiobook available on Audible and see the movie starring Ryan Gosling in theaters now. Project Hail Mary. Listen, watch, save the world. Listen now at audible.com/Hail Mary. And we're back with an all-new ghastly episode of Keep It. I'm Louis Vertel. We have with us today not just one of my colleagues, not just a standard of Keep It, but just one of my favorite people. It's rare they're all three, you know. It's Guy Branum. Welcome back.
Good to be here, Louis. I'm so lucky that you wandered into my life at Akbar so many years ago.
Yes, and I was, I guess, one of the few times in my life I ever did any networking. I was like, you should know me. Like, I was arms akimbo.
You instructed me that we should be friends, and you were right.
Yes, right. And then we went to, one of the first things we did was we went to Palm Springs together with a bunch of your friends.
Yes.
And you introduced me to a game that has not been played since, or I have not played it since, which was called Guy Ball.
Yes.
Which was, you had like a tic-tac-toe grid.
That's not Guy Ball. That's Guy Branum Presents Guy Branum's The Squares.
Okay, see, okay. Allow me. So it's a Hollywood Squares grid.
Yes.
And you would go around in a circle, putting a celebrity name in each of the boxes. Yes. As in, like, what would be the ideal Hollywood Squares board? You know the game show Hollywood Squares? Think of that. And then afterwards, Guy would not be a part of the putting the names in. Then afterwards, he would simply pick the three in a row he liked the best, and then also who was the secret square in the game. You turned me into who I am.
You're welcome.
Yes. Today we have a lot to talk about. First thing we're going to talk about is Project Hail Mary, which feels like a trick being played on me in that it's a huge hit.
Yes.
But then also everybody you know has read the book, but they've never brought it up before.
Yes. I mean, I think there is this weird unspoken hunger for competence porn, for stories about people being, I mean, but it's not just competence porn. It's also a story of a person being re-energized to take on a problem and solve a necessary problem. And I think that that's a space where so many of us are. And I think just like so frequently when I'm in an emotionally bad place, I will just read nonfiction. I will read a big book about the history of Prussia just to sort of like soothe myself. And I think there's something about a book like that, about like a problem getting solved.
Yeah.
That is really satisfying.
Well, also it's like, so I'm not a video gamer at all, but I do understand the going on YouTube and looking at people defeating a video game without ever making mistakes.
Yes.
Like that is deeply soothing, especially if it's like games I once played or something. I'm like, right. Oh, please, I want to see the Tomb Raider never get into a bad encounter with a Bengal tiger. She just mows right past it.
Yes. I mean, thinking about like, you know, somebody knowing the right path, just like wanting to know that somebody knows the right path. And I think we're in this very interesting, like, there's nobody coming to save us kind of situation. And like,
yes,
that really is the journey of Project Hail Mary. But it also comes with this other story of like, meeting people along the way,
yes,
and learning to value them, you know?
So Project Hail Mary stars Ryan Gosling as this guy, Ryland Grace, who is he's a school teacher, and he's reluctant to be sent out on this mission to go and basically save Earth because the sun is dimming, and there's some sort of thing called an astrophage he can collect over in Venus or something, and if he does that, maybe that'll solve our problems. But the catch is, there won't be enough, whatever, fuel to get him back here to Earth. So basically, it's a suicide mission.
Yeah.
And they're using him to get this world-saving thing done. And who's waiting for him back on Earth? The fabulous Sandra Hüller from Anatomy of a Fall and The Zone of Interest. I'm always obsessed with when somebody makes such a big splash in the prestige world, we have to do something with her mainstream. Like, we just did this with Carrie Condon in Banshees of Inisherin, and she was just an F1 in Train Dreams.
Well, but you know? Never bet on it when it's somebody from a foreign language film. What's the one about her and her dad having a weird relationship?
Oh, Tony Erdmann. Yes.
Like, that she was in this, like, weird 3-hour-long German comedy.
Yeah.
And we all, like, that Europe fell in love with her enough to be like, let's put her in these other great movies. And then we were like, well, I guess we have to do something with her. But there was that interesting way, like back in the 80s, like you would be in Das Boot,
yes.
and then you would come and be a bad guy in a couple of action movies.
Yes, right. The Klaus Maria Brandauer effect.
Yes.
Yeah. You're in Out of Africa and then also in Octopussy. That's how it works. No, but I, before we get into the movie, I'm going to say about her, you would not recognize Sandra Hüller from the other two movies she did a couple of years ago. This felt like a this is a true chameleon of an actress. Like,
yes.
I am currently re-energized. My offer her is re-energized.
Well, the thing is I would like the opportunity for her to be light in English, because
yeah.
she's her first film was a light comedy. It was in German, and no one feels light in German.
No, right.
And
the way the syllables hit alone.
Right. And, you know, like in an Anatomy of a Fall, she was just never giving us anything but like crystallized ice picks of lines.
Yes.
And I want to see, you know, it makes me wish that we were still making large ensemble comedies and
yes.
she could, you know, dive in and fall in love for a 15th of a movie.
Yes, right. Fat chance that will not happen. Yes, that's a bygone era. But this is also one of those movies where Ryan Gosling really is, in a way, the sole star, the person propelling the movie.
Yes.
And I like when we get
finally
one of
a Gravity for Men.
Yes. No, I try to say, right. Gravity is the obvious sort of predecessor to this movie. But we've had a few of these over the years, like All Is Lost with Robert Redford, where he's
yeah.
just on a boat that's sinking and you better get off those old knees and figure this out.
Yeah.
You know, Sleuth from the 70s, which is just Michael Caine and Laurence Olivier, and they're sort of stuck in a house. That's another one.
Well, and I mean, another ancestor is Apollo 13, because this is a film about all is lost unless we can get it all together.
Correct.
You
yes.
know, and like that feeling and that sensibility is so present, and like, it's a really interesting character for Ryan Gosling, because it is sort of like kind of a goofier guy than you
yes.
normally see in this kind of film. And so it really is able to capture those things that we love about Ryan Gosling, but also take him on a journey. Like, I think it is interesting for a man who played Ken to figure out, again, in a very kind of Sandra Bullock-y way, what is the thing that he can win an Academy Award for? And
yeah.
like, his signature comedy role in a supporting category was great, and it didn't win. And I think this is something that, even though it's being released early in the year, might have some traction. I mean, well, it's going to make a good deal of money.
Oh, it's crazy how much money it's already. Every year I'm sort of convinced, oh, we're done making money at the movies. But I also sort of think that after the Oscars, people get excited for other movies. They're like, let's bring on the new stuff.
Also, we want monoculture so bad. We want monoculture like as a main course, or maybe as a bento box
yeah.
with all of our niche culture. Like, we want to have that thing that we can talk to people about. And it's so funny that you're like, this story of people have all read this book and it's a huge bestseller, but aren't talking about it. And like, we want to have discourse not just online with these things, but with our friends.
Yes.
You know?
Also, I want to say, like, based on just casually surveying people about the book, the way people love it, I feel like the movie is a bit sillier and more comedic than the book
yeah.
is. Which is fine, but I feel like the awe that people have attached to it, you do get that in an IMAX screening of it, because there's a lot of visual splendor. In fact, the most impressive thing about the movie is how it looks, how he travels through this gravity-less sphere.
Yeah.
And how much comedy is wrapped up in that. Like, he'll bump up against things really casually, and it's really funny. The two directors, Phil Lord and Chris Miller, I do think add a greater comedy touch to the book than is previously there.
Yeah, these are the guys who gave us the animated Spider-Man movies.
Yes.
So it's people who are like thinking about the world and space in a dynamic way, but people who understand how to get jokes and fun into something. The novel, I believe, is by the same author as The Martian.
Yes.
And so it really is giving you a similar journey of process and lack of hope and all of that, but like on a bigger and sort of more conceptual screen.
Yeah.
You know?
I would also just say that it feels a little bit more Spielbergian, this
yes.
movie, and that it kind of feels more rated G, too.
Well, there's also, the first time I saw AI, I was very bored and annoyed by it, because like, I was like, it went so far to give you a happy ending.
Yes.
That I felt annoyed with it. And then I watched it later as a full adult and like was like, oh, guy, that was the point. It like the point is that humanness is the ability to imagine so hard that you're going to get there eventually. And I think that it did have that kind of Spielbergian optimism, which can, you know, felt saccharine and distasteful when we were all full up on it in the mid-90s. But I think now something we'd like to see. Like, somebody has to start imagining how this world can work again.
Yeah.
And this is a film that is like, I mean, in a big way, it's very on point because it's talking about, like, environmental disaster and having to solve that problem if we're going to keep human beings alive on this planet. But more immediately, it's about how do we believe in science and institutions and expertise enough to get ourselves moving forward.
But also, this is very much a buddy comedy because
yes.
What happens for most of the movie is he meets an alien in space. And I just want to say, if I get sent on an intergalactic science journey and most of my time is spent meeting somebody from the Jim Henson Creature Workshop, I don't know if my skills are being utilized to the best of their ability. But I will say, so he meets this like kind of crustacean looking creature who looks
a little rock man.
Yeah, he is dubbed Rocky. I have to tell you, and by the way, I believe a lot of it is practical effects. It's just puppetry used to make this creature occur. Through whatever science, we finally can hear Rocky talk back to him. They have normal conversations or whatever. I do have to say, sometimes the creature looked to me like the dancing chickens from the Peter Gabriel Sledgehammer video, and I could not get a... But it is sort of like claymation-y vibes.
I loved that we got just enough Arrival in this movie.
Just a soupçon of Arrival.
But I believe...
Not the whole Forrest Whitaker, just a tree.
I believe that we, again, 1990s into 2000s, got too good with our cute child technology, and it was overclocked, and stories never felt real because everyone was a Muppet. And also with our, like, adorable little sidekick characters, they were a little too much. Give me a Mushu and Mulan any day.
Uh-huh.
But I thought that Rocky really was, like, not too cute, and thus very cute.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, the thing I loved most about Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, is they found a little girl who you fell in love with, but did not seem like a cute, adorable little child.
She was great in that movie.
Yes. And like Rocky felt very similar to be like adorable. And by the end, you do want to hug him.
I think he's adorable. But at the same time, I do think he's a bit cliched as a character you meet along the way. And that he's got his robot feelings where he's like, what is this feeling coming over me? It must be love.
Yes.
And additionally, he, half the characters in Star Wars who are droids, he's like a little English idiom challenged.
Yes.
So it's like that same kind of like Perfect Strangers-y vibe.
We got to get comedy in the script somehow.
Yeah,
like,
that's true.
The thing is like right now, the problem with comedy is that it is hard to pitch like tone and character. It is easy to pitch plot. And I think little things like that are things that let the studio know along the way, yes, we are going to be having good times here.
Yes. Okay. Well, you fucking love this movie.
I really did.
Yeah.
Like, I was
amused. Yeah.
I just had, like, having a nice communal experience. I also just saw Pizza Movie from the guys who made Britannic.
Oh.
And it's a TBS comedy.
Like, oh, okay.
It's a little
bit. What we call a Bride Wars.
It's a little bit raunchier than that, but it's a TBS comedy. And that communal experience of watching something that is not a horror film and isn't a respectable drama is really, really satisfying to me. And I was surprised by what a sense of joy and optimism I had about the movie. And also, like, I just think it's very political in a way that isn't partisan or politicized.
That is true. I also want to say that comedies are basically the only movies I prefer to watch with other people in theater.
Yeah.
When I go to the movie theater, to me, it's like seeing, August Wilson on stage or something. Like, I'm dialed into only the actors. Nobody around me exists, etc. I want to know what I think of what's happening on screen. I don't need to share that opinion. I want to come out of the theater and be right about what I think.
You're reminding me of watching Tar with four other people in the middle of the afternoon in San Francisco.
Yes, right. You mean heaven? Yes. But a comedy, like, I like hearing the laughs reverberate and, you know, being a part of that.
Well, unfortunately, Pizza Movie is only going to be on Hulu. But I would say, like, it is something, this isn't about Pizza Movie, but invite friends over. It's a good time.
Okay. I'm sure you've already seen Project Hail Mary, but please let us know what you think. Here's what else is happening this episode. First of all, the fabulous Lisa Ann Walter is joining us from Abbott Elementary, but from so many other things. Parent Trap, she is a former stand-up. She started in stand-up and now has a stand-up special coming out. We, of course, have more Abbott Elementary from her. And she also happens to be the Celebrity Jeopardy champion from the first season of that show.
My pride in comedy people winning celebrity... So far, it's been Ike, it's been Lisa, and it's been Kamau.
Yes.
Like, That's a good run for comedy people. Take that, CNN.
No,
Kamau is on CNN.
Yes, right, yeah. Like 16 years ago, the finals for the big tournament they have were Michael McKean, Jane Curtin, and Cheech Marin. Again, comedians have it going on in this way.
This is just like the golden age of celebrity poker when, like, dude bros came and were like, I'm Ben Affleck, I'm going to win. And then the ladies of Mad TV fucking ate them.
Yes. I was just with Nicole Sullivan last week. She's such a doll.
A doll.
And a good friend of Ike Barinholtz's. Of course, from Mad TV. Elsewhere in the episode, though, another triumph for humankind is here. The Comeback is back for its third season over, what, technically 22 years or something. So we're going to get in why this Lisa Kudrow enterprise is, first of all, so beloved by gay men.
Yeah.
So beloved by gay men. But in general, just a boon for the comedy world and a boon for television.
Yeah.
And the first episode just aired. I would call this basically a prologue episode for what we're going to get later in the season. So, yes, we only have one episode to review right now, but we'll just talk about Lisa Kudrow in general and, you know, write little poems about her, I assume.
She is, to me, the greatest proof that God exists that we have on this planet.
Oh, good start. Okay.
It is a level of...
You're like Blake. Oh, my God.
It is like a level of nuance and talent that I think is so profound. Like, I recently, like a couple of years ago, went back and rewatched All the Friends. And Lisa Kudrow inhabited this character that should have been ridiculous and someone you couldn't have a relation, like, who was out in space, and she always grounded her in space. And I think that is the fun with Valerie Cherish, is that no matter how big she is, no matter how much she is embodying our worst cliches of a mid-level actress, you know her and you love her and you know that she and Marky Mark love each other.
Yes, right. No, she's flighty, but with gravitas. That's something that connects both those characters. And actually, that's also sort of true of Web Therapy, too, which was like more experimental than totally successful. But Fiona Wallach was a very memorable character, too. Anyway, all that and more during this very, I'll say, talky episode of Keep It. Keep It is brought to you by Quince. A thoughtfully built wardrobe comes down to pieces that mix well and last. That's where Quince shines. Premium fabrics, considered design, and everyday essentials that feel effortless to wear and dependable even as the seasons change. Quince has the everyday essentials I love with a quality that lasts. Lightweight cashmere sweaters, short-sleeve Mongolian cashmere polos, linen bottoms and shorts, tees in 100% Pima cotton, and European jersey linen. These are the versatile pieces that make a wardrobe actually work season to season. Quince works directly with top factories and cuts out the middlemen, so you're not paying for brand markup or fancy retail stores, just quality clothing. The cashmere is 100% Mongolian, the same stuff luxury brands use. The Pima cotton is long staple, which means it stays soft and doesn't pill. Woo! The European jersey linen is breathable and lightweight. Everything is built to hold up to regular wear and still look good. Their clothing is rated between 4.5 and 5 stars by thousands of people wearing it every day, and they only partner with factories that meet rigorous standards for craftsmanship and ethical production. I have so many t-shirts from Quince. I love shirts that I can throw in the wash a million times, and I know they will come out looking the way I want them to wear, which is to say, like I just bought them yesterday, and that is what Quince clothing does so well. Stop overcomplicating your wardrobe. You don't need a closet full of options. You need a few pieces that actually work. Right now, go to quince.com/keepit for free shipping and 365-day returns. That's a full year to build your wardrobe and love it. And you will. Now available in Canada, too. Don't keep settling for clothes that don't last. Go to quince.com/keepit for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/keepit. Keep It is brought to you by ZBiotics. Let me tell you, if there's a surefire way to wake up feeling fresh after drinks with friends, it's with pre-alcohol. ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was first invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's a buildup of this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for rough days after drinking. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember to drink pre-alcohol your first drink of the night. Drink responsibly, and you'll feel your best tomorrow. It's been a thrilling awards season, which means my friends have been enjoying some drinks at all of our watch parties. And lucky for them, I'm handing out pre-alcohol before the drinks even begin to flow. And sure enough, everyone is waking up effervesced the next day, just in time to write shady jokes about the winners and losers on the group text. I think we're all a bit skeptical about pre-alcohol initially, but once you see it work, you know it's the real deal. March is a marathon of social events from the slopes to the bracket watch parties to Guinness on St. Patrick's Day. Pre-alcohol is the tool you need to fully enjoy the end of winter. Go to zbiotics.com/keepit to learn more and get 15% off your first order when you use Keep It at checkout. Zbiotics is backed with 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember to head to zbiotics.com/keepit and use the code KEEPIT at checkout for 15% off. Lisa Kudrow has graced us with the return of Valerie Cherish on HBO's The Comeback, airing on Sundays. The series, which began in 2005, oh my God, think back to that for a second. Kelly Clarkson's emerging. We're still wearing too low of jeans. It's tough. Anyway, The Comeback is back, and it follows Cherish as she manages rehearsals for a staging of Chicago, acting on an indie movie set and recording her own podcast, First Off Guy, for the children who might not know the importance of The Comeback. Let's catch them up. And based on the premiere episode, are we on board?
So the premise of The Comeback is in the original show in 2005, Valerie Cherish was a washed up 1990s sitcom actress who had been successful, but not successful enough that she was set for the rest of her life. Mm-hmm. And she has the opportunity to be on another multicam, to have back the money and the fame that she had missed so much. But along with that part comes the necessity, like the network is also requiring that whoever gets this role also has to do a reality show about their comeback. And it's about this person who is used to the veneers of Hollywood, like being able to protect herself behind, the idea of glamour, and really wants to embody this glamour and this sense of being saved and protected by your
untouchability.
Who is forced to undergo the greatest humiliations in front of an audience to recapture the thing that she once wanted. Like, you can get the thing that you want, but only by giving up everything else that you want.
Right. I will say, when I first watched The Comeback, like in 2005, I thought I was just going to hate it because it was so rude to her. Everyone was so rude to her that I thought the entire joke was, watch this self-absorbed idiot go down hard all the time. But as the show goes on, it becomes more about the resources she secretly has to survive these horrible indignities. And also, the comedy of the show is that all of Hollywood, basically no matter who you are, but especially in her case, is one indignity after another.
Yes. The original review in the New York Times of The Comeback is a joint review with Entourage. And it says, Entourage is the fun, playful version of this show, but it's too hard and uncomfortable to watch this show that it also thinks is about us trashing this woman who we think is bad. Like, it is this very straight Gen X irony understanding of what that show could be, because we just didn't have the technology at the time to understand. We didn't have Snatch Game.
Yes.
And Valerie Cherish is the greatest Snatch Game performance of all time.
Yes.
It is like Lisa Kudrow being able to inhabit a character with a bunch of ridiculous, terrible tics and bad habits and like Gen X improprieties, but also loving this person and understanding that they are a genius at the dumbest thing.
Yes, right. Which reminds me, by the way, when I watched Nicole Scherzinger in Sunset Boulevard on Broadway, I would say the real wrinkle she added to that character is within the song With One Look, you get the sense that she was an amazing actress.
Yes.
Whereas in the original Sunset Boulevard, it's like maybe she had a moment of being really good, but she's totally lost that ability. Yeah. And I feel like that's part of what I end up loving about this show, too, is the sense that even though she is this flighty, completely not clued in woman, there is some technical ability there at the end of the day that is undeniable.
There are a couple of really great sequences from both of the previous seasons of The Comeback. But one of the iconic ones is like Valerie Cherish wants to lose weight because she's going to be on TV again. And also, she has like only one line in an episode because she isn't young and sexy enough. They're essentially writing her off of the show. And so you watch like static cam footage in her kitchen of her continuing to eat portions of a cake that she shouldn't be eating while just practicing the line, I don't need to see that.
And it gets more and more exaggerated and strange and accidentally horrific as she keeps going.
But then she fucking gets the laugh.
Yeah.
Like, then she gets the laugh and she lands it. And I think, like, the show is really challenging you to ask, like, what is the line between... it's a show about cringe. It's a show about cringe with heart. And I think it will be interesting to see how, you know, I don't know how much Gen Z is watching prestige HBO television, but at a point in time when the children are scared of cringe more than anything else, how will they be able to embrace Valerie Cherish?
I also think, by the way, like, this show is almost in danger of feeling watered down now, because since the advent of this show, so much of TV is about the cringe comedy. Like, every mockumentary we've gotten since then is about, like, awkward pauses and that person saying, revealing themselves with a line that, you know, they didn't mean to sound that stupid or whatever. But honestly, the take on Hollywood is so fucking bleak and dark in this that it's undimmed.
Well, it's like, there is no infrastructure left for her to cling to. And, like, one of the really delicious things about the first episode is she and Mark have moved to a condo. And she's very excited about it, but you can tell that this is a couple who are having to downsize.
Yeah.
Because the entertainment industry isn't what it once was. And that felt very real and relevant. But then there was just one moment, I don't remember what it was, where I just got maybe my first belly laugh in a while from a TV show. And it was just her ability to, like, with line delivery, with performances, with these things that Lisa Kudrow learned on the set of Goddamn Mad About You.
Yes.
applying it in these real naturalistic situations that just fills me with joy and fills me with love for this character.
Also, one of the hugest laughs of this episode, and maybe of just television this year so far, is you see the poster of her on Broadway in Chicago, and the look on her face is like, I'm going to try to imitate it now, which of course you can't hear, but it's like, like, it's between smiling and gasping and looking horrified, but it's like completely unflattering to her. She eventually leaves this production of Chicago, but not before getting into a fight with the cast where she asks them, she's like, why would you have me in this? I can't sing or dance. And somebody goes, I guess they just got to the V's. It's so brutal.
No, it really is. Like, truly, 10 years ago, right after, I mean, not long after the first season, she was at Chelsea Lately, and she was talking to my friend Heather, who she knew from The Groundlings, and she was like, this idea of Valerie Cherish as Roxy had been sort of with her for decades, and she was trying to figure it out. But it really is that, you know, the way that Casablanca was a movie about everybody who, like, the wretched refuse of Europe that had been scraped off during World War II. Like, Valerie Cherish is that, like, ultimate survivor, but necessarily refuse of this entertainment industry.
Yeah. I also worried this show wouldn't catch on anymore because it's like, what actor is honestly too cringe for social media anymore?
Yeah.
Like there's no bottom. You know what I mean? Like, influencers are so shameless that in a way, like, she not only fits right in, there's a resting dignity to her that she even does social media at all after being, by the way, an Emmy-winning actress.
Okay. Well, first of all, I just want to say that this morning I watched Jennifer Garner, a actress whom I am on record as having previously hated, but I have so fallen in love with her through social media and her baking. She played My Sonny Valentine for Reese Witherspoon on a saxophone for Reese Witherspoon's birthday. And it's just like, she is the best at social media. Like,
okay.
She really is, like, a
magical
person.
This is how I feel about Valerie Bertinelli. Where she just gets up, she goes, I'm having a terrible day.
Valerie Bertinelli, we talked about this when we interviewed her on
Valerie
the show.
Bertinelli, yes.
Yes, like, she has a level of sincerity that allows her to host a cooking show, which I think is the greatest level of sincerity required for any form of
for
entertainment.
Life, yes.
Yes. But the thing is like, that is the deeper story of Valerie Cherish that has been present for now 22 years in Lisa Kudrow's life. Like, this is taking, I think one of the best types of comedy is the person you almost were. I really love when Gilda Radner did Rhonda Weiss and the Rondettes, sort of like this cliche of a Long Island Jewish princess. And what did the world want me to be when I was growing up? And Lisa Kudrow, since the beginning of the comeback, has been saying, I am an actress over 40. This town wants to be rid of me. And is there something ridiculous about me wanting to stay? Is there something ridiculous about me not opening a pottery shop in Taos and just saying, like, I don't need the struggle that is required to maintain this? And this is a celebration of the power of Valerie Cherish's delusion.
Yes.
And the second season ends with, for the first time ever, Valerie Cherish leaves the cameras that are following her. There is a moment at the end where she's nominated for an Emmy, but her longtime hairdresser is in the hospital, and they're about to announce her award, and she leaves, and goes to her husband, from whom she was separated at the time, and she sees Mickey. The actor who played Mickey is no longer with us,
right.
And that is one of the very sweet and very beautiful parts of the first episode, is seeing these tributes to the person who really was the embodiment of her heart and the embodiment of...
just the sparkle of her life, basically.
But also the storied relationship between ridiculous too much women and gay guys who do hair.
Yes, right. Which, by the way, I don't believe I've seen in anything else before. So it's like it's still novel in a way. It's a very funny first episode, but we haven't gotten into the fact that she's about to embark on a sitcom that is written by AI. I did think it was unrealistic, though. Dan Bukatinski, who, of course, has been with the show since the beginning, co-created it, is her manager and just says to her, you don't even have to deal with writers this time. It's just AI. I don't even think a shitty manager would approach her that way. I think he would literally trick her into a meeting with people who like are going to throw her on an AI sitcom. That, to me, felt a little bald-faced.
Like, managers are really good at being sold on stuff from a studio and are really good at telling you the thing that they only half believe.
Yeah.
Trying to see if it will work on you. But in, like, the first and second season, the relationship between Valerie Cherish and, like, the first season was scary to me. The first season is still a little bit scary for me to watch because it was, like, a two-boy Harvard writing team who had previously written for The Simpsons, who were the guys who made up this town in 2005. They were, you know, the source of power, and they were very intimidating to me, and I had bosses like that. And like,
just like pure clique, you can't get into, it's just about them, you know. And so like someone like Valerie Cherish, they have open contempt for.
And like the greatest embodiment of male comedy by men for men cannot imagine women being anything but a straight man or an object of a joke. And that relationship is so like real and complex and present in the first season. And then the second season is very much about Valerie, like the guy who had tormented Valerie most, explaining that he had like a heroin addiction and a sex addiction at the time, and he does a prestige show to sort of like process that out. And Valerie starts to understand his complexity behind the veneers and facades of success in Los Angeles. Like, one of the great things about Valerie Cherish is that she believes Los Angeles.
Yeah.
She never looks behind the facade because she's
a very Joan Didion.
Right. And like, it will be interesting to see what this season is without that relationship, or positioning that relationship differently with this like AI thing.
Yeah. By the way, this show, which is, you know, vaunted among people like you and me, still makes me realize that there is a show that remains so underrated that actually was a reality show about this, which is Kathy Griffin, My Life on the D-List.
Yes.
Which I think, in the way that The Comeback is bleakly honest, that show also peaked at the bleakness of Hollywood, except still made it funny. It still did the thing you just said, which is she believes in the power of Los Angeles, even if the indignities are like tripling when she leaves the house.
Two things. The first one is just that My Life on the D-List must be read along with the comedy specials that Kathy was doing at the time,
because
those were her crystallized sort of like comedic takes on the experiences that you had gone through with her. And also My Life on the D-List did feature that relationship, but between fabulous too much woman and the gay guys who write for her, until Kathy fired them.
Yes.
But like, one of the things that you and I have both very responsibly avoided talking until now is the fact that this thing that is understood, Valerie Cherish, this performance that is understood as one of the great television performances, has lost the Emmy for Best Actress twice.
Both to Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
New Adventures of Old Christine and Veep.
And like a seventh of nine Emmys for Veep. It is just sort of like, why? And the thing is like, Julia Louis-Dreyfus has no projects this year. And so it's like, well, this is her time, except for the fact that we just found out, well, you guys just found out, because I write for Hacks, that this is the final season of Hacks.
Right.
And Jean Smart has won the Emmy for Best Actress in a Comedy every year that Hacks is on, because look at what Jean Smart is doing. And so this really is going to be a battle of the titans this fall.
Well, I will say, Lisa Kudrow is what I would call the Christine Baranski position, which is, imagine thinking she is anything less than a genius. She's a standard of comedy, and yet we only gave her one Emmy in the mid-90s.
Yes.
And we just thought that would be sufficient, basically, even though her work has gotten better and deeper, and you know, and she's the star of the show now. But at the same time, I think what you're also pointing out is that Veep was also a show for your dad.
Yeah.
You know, that was a boy show. There was one woman in the middle of the boys.
Right.
Hacks She's very endearing.
Written by a Harvard guy who had been a Seinfeld and I believe Simpsons writer.
Yes.
And had been part of a two-boy writing team.
Right. No, we're discovering the parallels as we do this. But I do feel like the comeback is in the hard position of people don't understand. A lot of people don't understand why this character is somebody you would follow.
Right.
Because in addition, I mean, it's understood that she's like dogged by how annoying and unfair and misogynist Hollywood is. But she also is so relentlessly self-absorbed. There's a scene in the first episode where she's at the writer's strike and she's preening for a picture alongside Fran Drescher. I mean, it's like Miss Piggy shit.
I mean, it is truly Miss Piggy shit.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, do we need Miss Piggy and Valerie Cherish to go be in Oh Mary? 100%. I think what could, because like the comeback has never gotten like a continuous season this like the year after it was made,
right?
Because it was never a real success.
That way it doesn't gain awards momentum either,
right? But I would say one of the differences between 2005 and now is 18 seasons of Drag Race.
Okay.
Like, yeah. I think that like the institution that is Snatch Game, the institution that is watching brilliant, delusional people be brilliant and delusional alongside people who are brilliant and less delusional, but just as fabulous, like has helped America understand camp enough to understand this like icon of 21st century camp.
But I also think there's just a general well-being feeling for Lisa Kudrow because she is this groundlings person who approaches everything with the joie de vivre and whimsy that comes with being an improv comic, which she's like, I'm developing this character. We'll see what works. We'll see what doesn't. She's not self-serious. And I feel like the general love for her, which has snowballed over time, could help her here.
Also, the relationship that new generations have with friends, and also what, like her press campaign for this has been really, really good. But Lisa Kudrow talking about for the first time in her life being able to watch Friends, apparently it was, she has talked about the way that after Matthew Perry's passing, she started watching the show and then recently was telling, I think, Conan that now she just had run through all the good sitcoms and she wants to watch an episode or two of a sitcom before she goes to bed. And so now she just watches Friends because she kind of doesn't remember it. But we also have to bring up the fact that she is one of the great talk show guests of all time.
Oh, and by the way, her interviews with the Television Academy, I've brought this up before, are so fabulous. She has such a great memory for like her auditions and episodes of the show and stuff. I much recommend it.
The best story, her being fired from Frasier, is one of the great stories. Her kind of hatred of the greatest multicam director of all time, James Burrows. I don't know that it's hatred because they did work together on Friends for 300 episodes, but she did believe that he tried to tank her in the pilot of Friends, and it's hilarious. But also, formerly dated Conan, knew him from the Groundlings, and their interviews previously on Conan's late night shows, but now on Conan's podcast, are just delicious. This amazing comedy performer removes an additional layer of self-censoring when she is around Conan, and it is beautiful to see inside.
I have truly loved her interview. She's somebody who's just so smart, and also the story specifically of trying out for Friends, where she's like, they didn't, like, Jim Burrows watched her perform and goes, no notes. And she goes, that could mean no notes, like you were great, or like you're not even worth dealing
after
with.
After she had previously been fired on the Frasier pilot, which he also directed. And so she assumed, like, this is all going again. He told her to deliver Phoebe's monologue from the first episode from underneath the table. And then apparently Marta Kaufman came up and was just like, why did you do that?
Yeah.
That is really a clear sign of the importance of having female showrunners, that instead of having people be like, she's crazy, Marta Kaufman was just like, what's going on?
Also, that's true. I mean, I literally think a woman being there probably was instrumental.
Yes.
Who knows? Who knows? But yes, this season of The Comeback will feature some uncharted stuff because we're not living in the timeline yet where actual AI is like writing our sitcoms beyond what's on, like, I think, Verticals.
Yes.
By the way, that's a part of pop culture I won't be invited to, and I won't accept the invitation once I go.
Louis Vertel, you're behaving as though we don't live in a world where that's the job of every very attractive 24-year-old gay guy or heteroflexible.
Oh, yeah.
Like, how are you not having conversations with these people at bars?
No, because I'm too busy talking about people like Sandra Hüller. Do you see?
Fair.
I live a cloistered, rarefied existence. Like you. Come on. Don't pretend you're not me. Stop it. Okay, anyway, we'll be watching. We'll be right back with more Keep It. But first, we are gearing up for the midterms, literally, with merch from the Crooked Store that does the yelling for you. Grab a due process freak tee and get ready to fight for the basic rights Trump seems to think are more taboo than actual pedophilia. Whatever issue is getting you out of bed and into a phone bank shift this year, the Crooked Store has merch to help you spread the message. Head to crooked.com/store to shop. We'll be back with Lisa and Walter. Keep It is brought to you by Smalls. Cats. They're sleek, elegant, and not impressed with your antics, just like me. Also like me, they're very particular about their food, which is why I'm excited to tell you about Smalls. If your cat could choose what they eat, I'm pretty sure it wouldn't be dry pellets from a bag. Smalls Fresh Cat Food is protein-packed recipes made with preservative-free 100% human-grade ingredients you'd find in your fridge, and it's delivered right to your door. That's why Cats.com named Smalls their best overall cat food. For a limited time, get 60% off your first order, plus free shipping when you head to smalls.com/keepit. Starting with Smalls is easy. Just share info about your cat's diet, health, and food preferences. Then Smalls puts together a personalized meal plan for your cat. No more picking between random brands at the store. Smalls has the right food to satisfy any cat's cravings. As somebody who doesn't have a cat but literally spent the entire last week babysitting a cat, not that stressful, actually a good time. I'm surprised I enjoyed it. Listen to this review from a real Smalls customer. Jennifer M. said, after every feeding, he gets this burst of energy and starts running around the house. And his fur is softer and more vibrant with higher contrast. Honestly, I wouldn't recommend anything else. Smalls was started back in 2017. Who remember that? By a couple of guys home cooking cat food in small batches for their friends. A few short years later, they've served millions of meals to cats across the U.S. I had to feed my friend's cat before he started using Smalls. And it took only one serving of the gray goo with questionable ingredients to insist he switched to Smalls. It's real food that his cat loves. What more could you want? The team at Smalls is so confident your cat will love their product that you can try it risk-free. That means they will refund you if your cat won't eat their food. So stop guessing which meals will upset their stomach. For a limited time, because you were a Keep It listener, get 60% off your first order plus free shipping when you head to smalls.com/keepit. One last time, that's 60% off your first order plus free shipping when you head to smalls.com/keepit. This podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. I don't know about you, but most of my friends have side hustles now, and some of them are actually becoming real businesses, from homemade ceramics to screen printing t-shirts, even interior design services. If you're looking to grow your side hustle, you need Squarespace. Squarespace gives you everything you need to offer services and get paid, all in one place. From consultations to events and experiences, showcase your offerings with a customizable website designed to attract clients and grow your business. Get paid on time with professional on-brand invoices and online payments. Plus, streamline your workflow with built-in appointment scheduling and email marketing tools. With Squarespace's collection of cutting-edge design tools, anyone can build a bespoke online presence that fits perfectly with their brand or business. Start with Blueprint AI, Squarespace's AI-enhanced website builder, to get a fully custom website in just a few steps. Using basic information about your industry, goals, and personality to generate premium quality content and personalized design recommendations. Squarespace also offers a complete library of professionally designed and award-winning website templates with options for every use and category. No matter where you start, your website is flexible to what you need. With intuitive drag-and-drop editing, beautiful styling options, unrivaled visual design effects, on-brand AI content, and more ways to list what you offer, no experience required. Fundraise directly on your website and grow your impact with built-in donation tools. Create a professional on-brand website that makes it easy to accept one-time or recurring contributions and engage supporters. With built-in email campaigns and marketing tools, you can connect with your community and inspire more people to support your cause. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/keepit to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. That's squarespace.com/keepit. We're thrilled to be joined by our guest, who is a hilarious comedian and actor who has wowed us not just in Abbott Elementary, but also in entertainment pillars such as Celebrity Jeopardy, where she ruled, and 1998's The Parent Trap. She's also booked and busy. You can see her in season 5 of Abbott Elementary on ABC. Her stand-up special streams on Hulu this spring, and starting April 27th, you can see her off-Broadway in Heathers, the musical. Please welcome the great Lisa Ann Walter.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I am
You know,
excited.
I've adored you for so long.
No, we followed each other. You make me think that Twitter is fun, which is, of course, a lie.
I haven't been there for a while.
I know.
But now I'm following you on Instagram, on other platforms that are run by evil empire geniuses.
Yeah, one tier less of evil or
yes,
something.
Yes, exactly.
Or evils slightly we don't know yet. Yeah.
100%.
But anyway, we're here with a guy who I guess we've hung out with recently.
Can I tell you my meet cute with Lisa Ann
Walter?
Please,
please do.
Chelsea Handler book party like a decade ago.
Oh, that's right.
Walk in, I see her, I'm thrilled because I loved her as a stand-up and I loved your sitcom on ABC, Life's Work. And so I went up to her and was immediately like, that show was so good. Larry Miller, it was so smart. It was so witty. It was so fun. I told her how much I loved it. We had a beautiful moment. And then I went off. Leah Remini was also there. And also your friend, I forget her name.
Elaine Hendricks, Rosa Blasi.
Rosa Blasi.
Rosa.
Rosa Blasi was also there. And I went up to Leah and Rosa Blasi and I started telling Leah Remini how much I had loved Living Dolls, her spinoff of Who's the Boss. And Lisa sidles up and is like, which your old shows is he saying he loves now? It's just, there's nothing better than having a great comic immediately roast you, immediately take you down. And since then, like, one of the glories of Los Angeles these days is anytime you run into the crew from Abbott, it's always a good time. You guys are such a success and you are like on top of network television. But every time I see any of you, it is only warmth and joy that I am getting.
Oh, you're so kind. Well, I mean, I think all of us feel very lucky to be in the position that we're in, and we're nice people, and that was purposeful. I think Quinta hired who she thought were going to be kind to each other on set. I think that's everybody from top to bottom in our crew, so there isn't anybody that isn't nice. It's one of the things that I'm proudest of on the show. Obviously the show is good, I think so anyway. But also when people come and visit and are guest artists on our show, they say there's no place that they felt more welcome. So that makes me feel good.
I was just at the GLAAD Awards recently and you guys were all there because Quinta was receiving an award. And I could immediately observe the vibe.
Yeah.
It was just like, oh, these are people who hang out.
Yeah, we like each other.
You know?
A question I have.
Sometimes we gossip. I purposefully have to not sit next to Janelle at award shows because we will talk shit.
Janelle? Well, by the way, I just wrote the SAG Awards and Janelle was so dynamite. She was my favorite presenter of the entire night.
Yes.
Like made it actual. Like some people, you forget that like patter is an art form. And like she comes up there and I was like, no, now it's all yours. It's like I didn't write it at all.
Yes, you know? Exactly. You
know? She's such a great stand-up comic. And like for such a long time, like women who were great stand-up comics like didn't get hours, didn't get to truly like break through and become icons the way that the dudes did and found work as writers or found work as actors.
Right.
And was so excited to find out that you were doing a comedy special. What was that? Most people, like a lot of people don't know that you were a stand-up. What was that journey like?
Yeah, that's wild. First of all, I want to say, going back to how you opened this, that it was really meaningful. I was being a smart aleck, but it was very meaningful when you said to me, I liked your show, I watched your show, because I co-created the shows that I was given based on my stand-up personality.
Yeah.
And they were really important to me because it was a representation of the women of my generation who were taught you have to do it all. Like from the time we're little, the closing bit in my act was about you got to raise a family, find a cure for cancer, have a flat stomach. You can't do it all. This is why we're bitches.
Yeah.
But that idea of balancing work and home life had not been on TV. There was either family shows or work shows. Mm-hmm. And you'd always see like a woman with a briefcase going, oh, today was a beast. And you'd be like, what'd she do again?
Yeah.
And I said, that's not the experience of anybody I know. So when people found that show and responded to it, it meant a lot to me because I created it. So thank you for that. I wasn't trying to be a smart aleck when we met.
Oh, I give you permission to be a smart aleck to guys.
Okay.
Stop.
All right. Yeah, well, then,
keep it going.
One of the things that truly amazes me is like, because your show followed Roseanne, right?
Yes. Like, we were on after Roseanne. And by the way, Roseanne in those years was top 10 show every year for a decade.
And you guys held the audience very well.
We actually built on her audience for a number of weeks that we were on.
And it's just really amazing to me that Abbott has now been on for like 5 seasons and we have not seen that companion, the ABC be able to produce that companion, you know, like another show with a comic, a show from one of your guys' writers and stuff. Like,
I think Scrubs might do it.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes, true.
Because, I mean, following Tim Allen show is, I think, where we are now. I think coming up in this season, we're going to follow Scrubs,
which
the reboot of Scrubs, which tonally is different from ours, but it's enough of a kind of a weird vibe, and it's funny, I think. I've watched the new one, and I think it's good, so we like that combo.
How much is watching comedy a part of your media diet? Like, do you find yourself needing to, like, be like who else is out there?
Comedies or, like,
anything at all, but really TV comedy.
Well, This is wild because my ADHD brain is like, I have to finish the thought that was over here, but it ties into what you were saying. So watch this. Mesh. I should have done a stand-up special when I first got to LA, when I was first like, oh, she's the next person we're going to offer a show to.
Yeah.
I used to joke and say like, oh, they're handing out shows to comics like Tic Tacs at the airport. Not true. You were very lucky if you got that brass ring to create your own show. And I had like an hour and a half, solid, not an hour and a half of fumfering, like an hour and a half that I could plan on where I knew where the applause breaks were, where the standing ovation breaks were. I got a standing ovation halfway through my show when I was doing stand-up back then. I should have done one then. But and like I was got to be friends with Whoopi Goldberg after I did a movie with her. She introduced me to Caroline at HBO and was like, we need to give this girl, we need strong women doing specials. And I'm sitting there like, ha, 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 you know, whatever. I should have.
Yeah.
I should have said, yes, we should do that. Because I was one of the top women at the time.
Yes.
And people now don't even know that I did it.
Right.
Right? So I didn't do it back then. There was maybe 10 female comics in the country that people knew their name.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
There was like,
Paula Poundstone. Margaret Cho. Yeah.
Margaret was a kind of along the same timeline as me. Janine Garofalo got to be known because then she did movies.
Yeah, Sandra, right,
Who else was there?
Sandra Bernhardt.
There was like not that many.
Right.
So getting one was really a big deal.
Yeah.
And what I was doing was different from what almost every other female comic besides Roseanne was doing, because I was talking about having kids and being married and trying to make a long-term relationship work and all that, you know, happy horseshit.
But, grounded and cerebral.
Thank
like,
you. All... And also, you know, ended with a bit about a blowjob to a hairy guy. You know, wasn't that cerebral.
That's exactly what I get in my head.
It was a thoughtful bit about a hairy blowjob.
Well, okay, one thing I find fascinating about your career is because I'm a little bit older and so I didn't connect with it, but the way that, like, for millennials, there is just an immediate love and adoration of you from Chessie and the Parent Trap.
Yeah.
And I just, what is that like negotiating a world where so many people, when they were seven, were like, I wish I had a friend like this?
Oh, it's so funny. People will come up and immediately start apologizing. The apology comes first. I'm so sorry. And then I know it's going to be something beautiful.
Yeah.
And then they tell me their story, or I get it a lot of times, you know, on social media. I didn't feel connected. I was gay. I was different. My parents divorced. I was unhappy. And you made me feel loved. And I thought if I could just get a hug from you, everything would be okay. And I'm going to make myself cry. I'm going to manipulate myself. But I would say, I don't want to bother you. And I know you're doing your thing. And I'm like, you would be surprised at how not bothered I am by that. Like, I have kids to ignore me. Like, this is fine. I love the love, and it makes me feel wonderful. I think any actor, if you're lucky enough to get a role that has impacted people, like, I'm not trying to say I'm Gandhi. Right. Like, I'm, you know, I did something that made people feel a little bit better, which at the end of the day, when I got on stage the first time and made people laugh and cry in the same show, I'm like, this is what I want to feel forever. I want to be on a stage looking at people and making them, seeing that I made them feel.
And also, by the way, clearly this role does have an iota of you in it, like the empathy factor. Like, so it must feel extra proud. It's like, you do see something about me in this.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And like the stuff, I think people respond very much to the scene where she says, I am Annie, and the response of Chessie to her and the immediate love. And I'll give you a behind the scenes secret about that. We were doing that scene for over the course of, I think, 3 days. I think we did 72 takes. And there was a lot of different direction that they gave me. What they wound up with, I love. I mean, I appreciate the fact that Nancy Myers was, like, so meticulous and brought it around to what it became. But there was a minute there where I thought, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And I was doing all of this actory stuff, like before the threshold stuff, where you sit and you get yourself in a place of where you could be vulnerable to that moment. And all I could think about was leaving my daughter. When I was on the road as a stand-up, I worked up until I had already had a son. I started doing stand-up when he was like a year old. And then my daughter was 4 years later. I worked until 3 days before I had her. I went back to work when she was 5 weeks old because we had bought our first house, $175,000 in Jersey. So I'm telling you, it was a nice house too. I should have kept it because I could be making bank renting it. But I missed her so much when I would go on the road. I mean, I was still nursing her when I left. I'm pumping into a Ziploc bag and putting it in the freezer at the comedy club. Like, this is shit that guys who are like complaining about their bad Denny's breakfast will never deal with. I was on stage, like, in the first time I went back, it was at Comedy Connection in Rhode Island.
Uh-huh.
And I'm on stage and I'm talking to the audience and I was talking to them about having a baby. And I'm like, I'm peeing right now. I'm literally incontinent, leaking milk and peeing. Like, everything was liquid. But I did that because, you know, I had bills to pay.
Yeah.
But when I would have to leave her, when I got home after being away for 5 days or 4 days, I would walk in the door and immediately smell her because we're mammals. So I'm like, where is she? And I would smell her and run to her and smell her head and like breathe everything about her in. And that was the place that I was in before I would shoot those scenes for that scene, those takes for that scene. And so that idea of missing this thing that, because I think Chessie is, those are hers. Those babies are hers.
Yeah.
And when one of them goes away, she misses it like it's one of hers.
Yeah.
She raises the other one like it's her daughter.
Right.
Right. So so that's where I was. So when people respond to it, it's because what I was doing was real.
Yeah.
Was
you put it on the line. Jesus. Yeah.
Thank
you.
That was way too long a story. I'm sorry.
It was
You're
a good
like,
story.
Bitch, we got 10 minutes. Let's,
no,
let's
it was
go.
A fabulous story. Fabulous story.
So how much have you been able to do stand up over the last 20 years?
I did stand up, of course, when I got to L.A. and then you have to do showcases and then the networks want to do a TV show with you, whatever. And then I was doing the show like Quinta's doing this. That was me. I was like writing. I was on stage, if, you know, for every scene. I was, if I wasn't actively producing the show, I was out promoting the show. I was flying to New York. I was doing gigs all over the, not comedy gigs, but doing promotional gigs. And I had two kids. So I was busy.
Yeah.
And so I did not do stand up then. And I should have. I should have never let that dip at that time because then it was always a question of coming back into it and working up the material because my material was always based on where I was in my life.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And to me, stand up is funny complaining. Like the comics that I loved when I was a kid were the people that were truth tellers like Richard Pryor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like I didn't respond to there. First of all, there weren't any female comics that you got to see. There was like. There was Joan Rivers and Phyllis Diller.
Yeah.
And they weren't talking about stuff that sounded real to me.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. So I gravitated towards the truth teller comics. Mm-hmm. And that's what I always did. So when I got to a point in my life where I was like starring in a TV show, it was really hard for me to do stand up that I thought was relatable.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, I'm not talking about a regular life. This is a weird ass life I'm living.
Yeah.
Then my husband came out to me in between the first show and the second show. And he didn't want the kids to know. He didn't want our son to know because he was not comfortable yet with who he was.
Yeah.
Right. So he didn't want him to think differently about his father. And I couldn't really talk about my life and avoid that entire part of it.
Yeah.
So I didn't do it for a long time.
Oh, that's
I started
so interesting.
To, yeah. I started to do it again. And then I got with the father of my twins and he didn't think I should do stand up because he thought it wasn't feminine.
Oh, damn. God.
Yeah. And told me that. And I'm in it. If I showed you a picture of him, you'd be like, okay, I get it. I get why you were a moron. That's right.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
If you have any question about why this is a comedic voice
Daddy.
That I connected with in the 90s, this is becoming very clear.
I'm going to show you a picture when we're done with this, and you're going to be like,
I'm
going to
give up
it.
My comedy for good.
I get it more. Queenie. Yeah, exactly. And he said, I should be doing stand-up. I'm the funny one. And I'm like, tell one joke on stage.
That reminds me of my rule I have about supporting comedians, which is make me laugh once. I can't root for you unless you make me laugh one time.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like a real laugh.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that I remember.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. So so I didn't do it when we were in that relationship. And I also had twins and I was doing a show, an hour-long show in Vancouver. And, you know, hour-long is just, it's a bigger day.
Yeah.
It's like you're gone for like 12 hours and then I'm coming home and nursing twins. Like I just didn't have the time in my life. Since then, I've never stepped out of it.
Uh-huh.
I'll do it more, I'll do it less, but I've never stepped out of it. Sherry Shepherd was the one who like dragged me back into it and said, come on, we're going out. You're going to gigs.
That doesn't surprise me. She has that real like workhorse, like let's work every day on something energy.
Yeah. Know? And when she was starting, when she was a baby comic, like had done only a few gigs, I met her at a charity event in 98, 99, like really young. And she got my number and stayed in touch with me and, like, called me for advice. And then we wound up doing a show together, a little NBC show, and we stayed friends and went through divorces together. Uh-huh. And, you know, all this stuff with her getting the job on The View. And so we stayed friends all the way through. When she moved back to L.A. is when she, like, said, you taught me how to cook. I'm going to snatch you.
You would be such a good View panelist. You've got the exact energy.
I would be.
And also, you're actually up on things and get ready for this, know about things. Oh, my God.
How about that?
Yeah.
Right?
Which brings me, of course, to, we have to talk about Jeopardy.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, Guy and I were talking about before we got into the room that, first of all, if you're not aware, at least Ann Walter won the tournament of Celebrity Jeopardy, which qualified her to play in the actual Tournament of Champions, which is, by the way, I mean, some
bring
of the hardest trivia ever on television.
I've never seen a harder show than that Tournament of Champions game that I played. Never.
The actual game you played was extremely hard.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for saying
but
that.
Also, yes.
Because I don't think I'm the smartest person in the world. My dad was a NASA physicist.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Like, there are smart people in the world that I don't know anything near what they know. And some people have those brains where they remember everything. That's not me. I know stuff because my mother was a teacher and talked about things and lectured just for fun. And I watched old movies and stuff. So I know about music and all this. I traveled. I know about art. I don't know that stuff. But I watch Jeopardy. And I can win a regular game of Jeopardy, no problem.
Yeah.
I'll get the final Jeopardy when all those smart people get it wrong. That game was bullshit.
Yes.
That was bullshit.
And also, I think, and very
never
little
seen
pop
a
culture,
game.
Too. Very little pop culture,
no,
too.
No, none.
Yes.
None.
Yeah.
There was a math category.
Yeah. Which, by the way, this is a hard take. Math is not trivia.
No. Thank you.
It is academic in a way that is not trivia.
No, that's a formula.
Yes. Dang. We were talking before you came in about how the celebrities who have done best at Jeopardy are all funny. It's like, you know, like
true.
Back in the day, like Michael McKean, Jane Curtin, and Cheech Marin were the big, like, Jeopardy players. And recently is Kamau Bell.
Yeah.
You. And
Ike
what
Barinholtz.
Is it about? Yeah. Ike Barinholtz, of course. What is it about being funny that makes somebody a good Jeopardy player?
I think that it's the other way around.
Yeah.
I think that smart people are good comics because you have to pull. If you're a good comic, your references are pulled from everything.
Yeah.
I say stuff on stage all the time that I know nobody knows. And, you know, I've had people go, like, nobody's going to get that reference. I'm like, that's on them. I explain it in the joke. Contextually, they'll get it. And then if they still don't get it, I'm like, and I know that because I'm a Celebrity Jeopardy winner. But I mean, I think that when you're smart, you're quick. And your brain is already, maybe it's a little bit to do with ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
You're pulling from the wealth of your information all the time, right? As you're thinking up tags and references and literary connections and as a writer, you do that.
Yeah.
But I think that is what makes for a good, quick, funny voice. And so then you, of course, do well in Jeopardy because you're already smart.
Yeah. But it's always like dramatic actors feel fucking thrown up there. They're like constantly startled they're in a game, whereas someone like you is like next.
Well,
you
know? And also, if I'm going to be crap at the game, which I was, I had two killer lines. I'm like, I had two really good laugh lines, but I don't know if they kept it because I can't watch the episode.
Oh, yeah. No. I lost my episode and I did pretty well in it and I can't watch that.
Yes.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
No.
No.
But Ken is an amazing broadcaster, and it is so delightful to watch how good he is at that job, considering that, like, his performance experience is just being on that show a bunch.
100%. I think what makes him good at it is he has the gentle nature that Alex Trebek had a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, just funny enough, but not trying to be all quippy be funnier or more interesting than the gameplay. And he has a love, I think, for the people playing it. He's been there, so.
He is unusually rad. Like, I just like his politics. I like where he's coming from.
Yeah.
And also, it's like, it's the rare case of, like, Charlie getting the chocolate factory, right?
Yes!
And so it's just, like, so amazing. Like, when has that ever happened in
Never.
Pop culture? You know?
You, like, root for him.
I mean, we are in this moment of, like, getting to, so much else is bad that we're just so happy when a nice thing happens. Like, everyone is just so happy for those heated rivalry boys.
Oh my God, new stars. Yes, imagine.
Exactly. Look, they came from nowhere. The week before, the guy was waiting tables, was he?
Yes, right.
Yeah. So you're just like, yes. Good. And stay famous.
Yeah, right. Keep it up.
And keep wearing this sheer shirt.
Yeah. Now, Lisa, we have to talk about Heathers the Musical.
Oh, please do.
I assume you are a huge fan of Heathers the
Movie. Of course. Yes.
I am, of course, Winona Ryder filled when it comes to Little Women. Heathers secondarily. Tell us about this take on Heathers, how it evolves the story from the, I guess, 1988 original.
Geez, you know what? I'd be talking out my butt if I was trying to say what made it different, because I haven't seen it.
Oh, wow.
I haven't seen it. I'll see it the first time live. I mean, I've seen, you know, portions that they sent me for mm-hmm. my character, but I will see the whole thing all together when I show up for the start of my rehearsals.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I don't have a take on it yet. But I mean, I read it. I read the book. I read the script, and it was... You know, it was interesting because I remember the movie very well because it was so different.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was so different from anything that we had seen. You know, we all saw movies that were like, you know, oh, this is a mean girl teenager and this is the one we root for. And we yeah. all saw those movies. Cruel Intentions, a little bit different.
Yeah.
Heathers comes out yeah. and you're like, these people are homicidal. Yeah. Like, then it became wild. But the facts of what happened in that movie and the accidental death, and then they're going to take a play on it, and then the guy that you root for in the love triangle turns out really dark, and yeah. then you're wondering, why is he dark? And, you know, you're rooting for them even though it's really bleak, and, you know, it was different from anything that we saw. And then when I read the script for the musical, I went, this explains it to me so much more mm-hmm. yeah. than what you... It basically said to me... There is damage all around. All of us are dealing with the damage that other people don't know about. You don't know why that bitchy girl is that bitchy girl.
Yeah.
But I bet you a funny uncle touched her in a bikini area.
Yeah.
You know, something happened somewhere that turned that person. And our job is to try to lead with our own heart and kindness. And I that people are ridiculous. Because my character is ridiculous. But you root for the kids to win. And I think that that's what speaks to, from what I understand, is a rabid young audience that goes to see the show. Because
yeah.
they're dealing with stuff I didn't have to deal with growing up.
Yeah.
I didn't have school shootings when I was growing up.
Yeah.
We had nobody paying attention to us. That's what we had. We had me running through a field with a bumper bottle of Old English 800. My mother didn't know where I was. And cops would watch me, just like, look at her.
Gen X, periodically we got abducted, but yeah. you know.
Yeah, we made it home. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you guys invented the term strangers for me to learn, the yeah. millennials. Yeah, yeah. yeah. Oh, I could get taken.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. My mother did warn us, but that was pretty much it. Yeah. She was like, don't do this. Or she'd have smoked. I'm gonna do a smoker voice because it's funny. Don't go with that guy because you'll never come home. You know, I mean, and then you just spend your whole life going, okay, I guess that's what sex is.
Now, my last question for you, and this is a holy question. I don't ask this to just anybody.
Yeah.
Who's your what's your favorite actress performance ever? If I named you, if I asked you to name like a movie performance you constantly go back to, what is it?
I think Jesus, now I can't remember the name of the movie. Peter O'Toole is the king. Catherine O'Hepburn
is Lion and Winter. Winter.
Yes. Lion and Winter. Catherine Hepburn in Lion and Winter.
68 Best Actress, a tie. Yeah.
Thank you. With?
Barbra Streisand.
Thank you. Cate Blanchett in the first Elizabeth movie.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is magnificent. I'm going to, you know what's going to happen is I'm going to leave here.
Yeah, yeah. yeah.
And
come up
think
with 15.
Of 20. I mean.
Well, Catherine Hepburn in Lion and Winter, that yes. line about it's 1066 were all barbarians or whatever, yeah. or 1185 yeah. or whatever.
Yeah. What would you have me do? Give out, give up, give in?
Yeah, I'd hang you for the nipples, but I'd shock the children. I can't, I mean, there are newer movies that I love the performances. Tell me one of yours and that'll make me think of one of mine.
Well, I'm obsessed with Sandy Dennison, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
That's a beautiful
and also Elizabeth Taylor in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Yes.
And Maggie Smith in The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie is my other favorite one.
Fun fact. When I was a kid, we used to go see drive-in movies. That's yeah. what you would do with your family. They'd make a big bag of popcorn in a brown paper bag, and you'd take that and eat it because we were cheap. And there would be two movies. There would be a movie that they played first that was like Song of the South or something uh-huh. by Disney. And then you were supposed to have an intermission where you played on the swings at the drive-in.
Yeah.
And then you were supposed to go to sleep, and then another movie would come on. The first boobs I ever saw in a movie was The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie.
Yes,
and I was supposed to be asleep. I watched yes. every movie I shouldn't be watching in between the cracks of the car seat. There were two seats yes. that would go down like this, so I would watch in between the cracks because I didn't want them to know I was awake. I watched a bunch of movies like that. Oh, God. Who was the other one? There was another historic movie that I absolutely loved.
Ooh, I feel like I can suss it out. What would it be? Maria Falconetti, A Passion of Joan of Arc.
No, but that's a good movie.
Yeah.
Oh, I like your taste.
Oh, yeah. Oh, please. Yeah, yeah. It's all I have.
Modern. What about a modern one? What's your favorite modern one?
Oh, Cate Blanchett and Tar, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was raw.
Yeah.
And that was raw.
And
man.
A lot.
She was a lot.
That movie is a beast. Yeah.
She's probably my favorite actress, not American, she's Australian, but favorite actress working in English today. I told her that. I got to meet her and I told her that.
Ooh.
And she was standing next to Bill Nighy.
Oh, yes.
not the scientist. Bill
yes.
Nighy.
Oh, yeah. Yes. They were in No Time to Scandal together.
Yes. And they were standing talking. It was at a BAFTA tea. And I saw her and I went, I never approach people. I'm always embarrassed. I think they're going to be like, and that happens occasionally. De Niro did that to me. I was heartbroken. So, you know.
Oh, he seems so friendly. I'm kidding.
He had just been talking to Cheryl Lee Ralph. And Janelle needed help with her dress. We were at the Critics' Choice Award. Janelle needed help with her dress. So I wasn't able to get over when Cheryl was talking to Nadine because they played together in Mistress.
Right.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I thought if I get there, then she can introduce me and it won't look weird. But I made it after Cheryl left. So I had to go, I'm in the show with Cheryl. And he was like, and?
Yeah.
But I don't approach people. I did approach Cate Blanchett and I said, you're my favorite actress, you know, working today. And then, of course, I had to look at Bill Nighy and go, you're great too. Which is ridiculous.
Like, yeah.
He's fabulous. He is great. He's one of my tops.
Yeah.
But not the favorite.
What was that movie? Living? Yeah. He was great in that. Yeah.
Yes.
No, that was a very qualified answer. You seemed so terrified to answer it, and you answered it brilliantly.
Yes, and she does the other, like she played Kate Hepburn in the
Aviator,
Mm-hmm. And she does American accents really well, which a lot of them think they do and they don't. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of Brits that are, you know, everything is theirs. Like every vowel is elongated to kingdom come. You're like, we don't all talk like that. Take it easy.
I wish there was a way to do a podcast with working actors about the actors they cannot stand, but there's no way to do it. Like, you know, it's like you can't out yourself as like, oh, they suck every time.
No. You know? Yeah. And I don't even know if there is anybody I feel that way about. Like, I always look at it like, I mean, maybe there's a couple, but most people I look at them and go, that's not their fault.
Yeah, right. No,
like they shouldn't have gotten hired for that, or they got shit direction or whatever.
Hepburn in the early 80s talking shit about Meryl Streep is hilarious.
Wait.
Is she the one that she runs the gamut of emotions from A to B?
No.
That was Dorothy Parker.
About Catherine Hepburn.
That's what I'm talking about. Yes. Catherine Hepburn.
No. Yes. She was like, you can see all the gears moving all the time.
Mm-hmm. I got to tell you something. Let me tell you a little something. Here's a favorite performance of mine. Miss Meryl Streep, who cries in every accent.
I know what it's going to be.
Okay.
She Devil.
Everybody loved.
I knew it. I said it. Yes.
I hate you. I can't stand you. The performance.
Yeah.
I watched that movie and I'm like this, Meryl Streep with the crying. You lost your kid, the dingo. I get it. Okay. Yeah, whatever. Out of Africa. On and on and on and on. I could not be less interested. I'm like, she cries pretty. Beautiful. She's got a Patricia nose. Great. She does She-Devil. I'm like, this bitch can act.
Fucking 88. We didn't know that she could do comedy. Like we had. Yeah.
And not just comedy. Physical?
Yes.
Insanity?
Yes.
Just unhinged? And the accent, the weird, the character within a character, because you know that's not her. The crazy, she's Jersey playing. She's Martha Stewart, I guess, or some version of that. But it's a performance beyond.
It's also one of the rare Meryl Streep performances where you can picture the other people they would have, like, organically chosen. Like, someone like Goldie Hawn or Bette Midler or something.
Yeah.
And then you see her do their thing, but, like, bizarred the fuck out. Yeah. So it's just, like, there's a lot of, we'll say, 4D chess going on with her fucking brain. She could zoom into any role in any movie and be like, watch this. You know?
And then after that, she did Postcards from the Edge, which is one of my favorite books. That was a Carrie Fisher book, for those of you who don't know, about her dealing with rehab and getting clean and sober and everything. It's beautifully written, very funny and dark.
Yeah.
And Meryl Streep played the shit out of that too. And yeah. Shirley MacLaine as basically Debbie Reynolds.
Yeah. No, Shirley has two movies she should have gotten nominations for and didn't. That's one of them. And Being There is the other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Her falling off the bed masturbating.
Hilarious. I mean, also, it's like, what other movie is like that? And she is like essential to the tone of it.
Yes.
Anyway.
Lisa, let's do more movies. I have to leave now.
I know. It sucks. Yeah.
I know. We should have been doing this. We were doing all that boring stuff about my career at the beginning.
Yeah. Oh, God. Then you brought up The Lion in Winter. Damn it. Yeah.
Look, this was really a good movie, right? Did I pick a good one?
Oh, yes.
Okay,
yes.
Good.
This is really fun. But the important thing is, we are getting Lisa Ann Walter stand up in a special.
We
like,
are.
30 years after I thought I wasn't getting any more of it. And that's really exciting.
What a delight.
Thank you, Guy. Thank you. I appreciate that so much.
And also, let me just say that, like, the counterpoint to you meet De Niro and it's not great is 15 years ago, I walked up to somebody I admired and I said something to them. And then you have been a friend to me every time I've seen you since. And I like it really is magical when this town is good.
Yes.
You know?
You know what? I so badly want to say something else, but that was such a good button. That was such a bring it home moment.
Well, you work
in
TV.
I'm not going to step on it. I'm like, and thank you.
Yeah. Lisa and Walter, thank you so much for being here. Check out Abbott Elementary Wednesdays on ABC, in case you haven't heard of it. And on Hulu the next day. Her stand-up special is also on Hulu this spring. And if you're in New York, check out Heather's the Musical starting April 27th. That's coming right up.
Yeah, I don't like to sit down.
Yeah, no, brilliant. Yeah, correct. We'll be right back with more Keep It. Keep It is brought to you by Koyuchi. I'm so excited to tell you about our sponsor, Koyuchi. Koyuchi is in a league of its own when it comes to bedding, bath, and home products, and their organic sateen and flannel sheet sets are the key to more comfortable, healthier sleep year-round. If you're a human with an Instagram account, there's a good chance you're seeing ads for bedding every day. And who knows whether these companies, which seem to multiply every day, are any good. Koyuchi stands above the rest because of their 35-year heritage, their extraordinary quality, and their commitment to ethical production. 35 years, now that's enough time to make you master the art of bedding. Koyuchi is luxury you can feel good about. Whether it's bedding or bath towels, table linens, crib sheets, or spa robes, all of Koyuchi's products are of the absolute highest quality, made with natural fibers, low-impact dyes, and certified fair trade. Koyuchi looks great, feels amazing, and is good for your health and the planet. If you want healthy, organic luxury bedding that lasts a lifetime, you need Koyuchi. Get 15% off your first order when you visit koyuchi.com/keepit. That's koyuchi.com/keepit to get 15% off. koyuchi.com/keepit.
Hey, so listen, whether you're in the States, across the pond, or somewhere on the other side of the world, we love that you tune into Crooked for US News. But did you know we also have a UK news show? Yes, that's right. It's called Pod Save the UK.
Pod Save the UK is a no-bullshit, unabashedly progressive conversation about politics focused on the issues that matter most to the people of Britain. With all the changes in our government, including the fun revolving door of prime ministers we have here, there's always lots to talk about.
And there's lots of fabulous guests to talk to. Journalists, politicians, experts, comedians and activists.
Yeah, we've had great comedians on as well, like Rosie Jones, Stuart Lee, Aisling B. We've also had Tommy Vietor on, who may be our boss.
We still don't know.
We're not quite clear on who our boss is. I thought it might be Tommy Vietor. I thought it might be Jon Favreau. I don't know if it's John Lovett. It's hard to say. It's not clear to us who our bosses are.
Some of our listeners call us irreverent but not stupid.
I object to that. I'm deeply
stupid.
It doesn't
sound too bad. So look, come check us out. Come join us. Pod Save the UK every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And it's time for the saltiest part of the episode. It's Keep It. Guy, what's rankling you?
In honor of Lisa Ann Walter, saying they probably don't want to do stand-up anymore, you guys can keep it. Like, for so many years, there have been amazing stand-up comics, like Michael Patrick King, the creator of
Sex
and the City, and The Comeback, the co-creator of The Comeback, people like Lisa Ann Walter, so many great comics who were women or queer, who there wasn't a space for in stand-up, who didn't have, like, Margaret Gomez, who is still doing amazing solo shows in the Bay Area, but who got to 7 minutes on television, and then they didn't know a next step for a lesbian Latina. And like so many of those people, there was just the assumption, oh, she's happy now, she has a writing job. Oh, she's an actor now, she's happy doing that. She doesn't want to do stand-up anymore. And so many of those people were great comics, and I did not get to see comics like me. I didn't get to see the comics who inspired me go all the way that the straight dudes got to, because those people were tired of fighting too much of a fight and had another way of making money, and like ended up like doing that because it was the thing that this industry had for them. But like saying, oh, this is probably their preference, like let's not do that, and let's keep our arms and heads open for the people who are doing it. And in honor of that, I want to say Jackie Cation has a new special on YouTube. It's called Altercation, and it's so much more political than Jackie Cation has ever been, because this world demanded it of her. And A Prodigal Daughter by Taylor Tomlinson is on Hulu, I believe. And she is somebody at a very different point in her career, but she is somebody who made the conscious choice to give up industry success to be able to focus on and double down on stand-up. And I love and I'm so proud of both of them. And I love and I'm so proud of Lisa Ann Walter for saying, this is part of my artistic journey. This is a part that is unfiltered through somebody else, and I want to do it.
No, I mean, I routinely call comedy, this sounds so pretentious, but it's just true, the blues of comedy,
yes.
Which is just like you get up and like you have to expose something and hopefully the truth resonates or whatever, but it is very intimate.
Yeah.
You know, like even if you're playing a character to a certain extent, it's still like a mano version of comedy, and it is like, you know, a speed dating or something.
Right, and comedy acting, so many of these other things where we're more comfortable seeing women perform, it isn't about their unfettered perspective. We don't adore unfettered perspective from women, and also we have been weird about it from queer people, and I hope, but now that we do have successful queer stand-ups like Mateo Lane, I really, really hope that people like John Rigi, who wrote on The Comeback and was a great stand-up, like if he decided like in his third act to drop an hour, I would be thrilled.
I do feel like in general there needs to be more respect for the elder comic, though.
Yes.
You know, it's like there's some lingering thing that like stand-up is a young person's game, that they have to have that Eddie Murphy feeling of just like erupting out of nowhere, pissed and brash.
Yes.
You know, where it's like, I think, I mean, I don't want to call people weathered, but I think like earned experience makes stand-up a lot better most of the time.
Yes, it's like, I love Maria Bamford, and every time she has like a major life event, I'm like, we're going to get something amazing out of this.
Do you know what I honestly think about a lot? Is Maria Bamford gave a commencement address one time where she talked about all the shows she's been fired from, and one of them was like Hot in Cleveland.
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking, what on earth were you fucking doing in the Hot in Cleveland writer's room? But this is what you're talking about. Like, we don't know what to do with certain people,
yes,
and they've got to work. And it's just like this whole like finagling of where do you put your weird motherfucking voice? And sometimes you have no choice but to like strike out on your own.
But also like a misuse of the people who weren't weird enough and could fit themselves into that system.
Yeah.
That like Carol Leifer was the equal of Jerry Seinfeld and always has been, but she ended up in writer's rooms and Jerry Seinfeld got to be one of the biggest comedy stars in the world.
One of the biggest Pop-Tart cinematic universe creators we'll ever have. And now it's time for my Keep It. Keep it to whatever is happening with this fucking Chapel Roan situation. I am on record as saying I think people treat celebrities horribly. I think people are resentful of the fame of celebrities. And when they get the chance to meet a celebrity, what's going through their mind is, I know who they are and they don't know who I am. And I'm going to change that for good. Like, there's literally a resentment of the perks that fame has, that they get to walk through life being known while the rest of us, you know, are stuck in the dungeon or whatever. Anyway, so this story has emerged that this soccer player, I'm going to say his name is Jorginho. I don't watch the sport. I don't watch. I played super soccer on SNES in 1992. That's the last time I clocked in with the sport. Anyway, his young daughter and this guy were at a hotel in Sao Paulo. The daughter, who's 11 years old, sees Chapel Roan, has a titter about her, is a big fan, allegedly maybe runs by the table to see if it's Chapel Roan for real. And then moments later, a security guard, who Chapel Roan says is not related to her security detail, goes up to her and says, stop bothering the celebrities, gets up in her face. And also, by the way, this woman is this 11-year-old is actually Jude Law's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So she wanted to go meet Chapel Roan, and instead she encountered a cold mountain of a man.
You knew he would get there, guys.
Yeah,
you knew he would
get
there.
You're like, this is a long walk, and why? Anyway, a celebrity having a security guard who says something rude to you should not affect what you think of the celebrity. I'm sorry. Be smarter than this. You're 11 years old. When I was 11 years old, I knew not to meet Madonna. Well, do not meet Madonna. If you love Madonna and what she stands for, what she says to you one-on-one does not matter.
But also, your dad is Jude Law and your other dad is a huge soccer star.
Yes.
In parts of the world that care about soccer. Like, maybe understand a little bit more. Like, and also, this is somebody who has access of a sort that most kids don't, of being able to, like, walk up to her breakfast table and stuff. But also, it's an 11-year-old. You understand why she was sincere in that moment. And I really, really enjoyed Chapel Roan's, like, video explaining the situation from her hotel bed.
Yes.
And, like, people get really upset about the way that this very young star has been managing her fame. But I really thought that a moment like that was really sincere and lovely.
Yes.
And shows, like, the fact that she can manage this stuff.
Also, it does seem like a weird situation. I kind of can't tell who knew what the entire time.
Right.
But the amount of people who have come out of the woodwork to be like, well, it's fame. You have to take the good with the bad. No, you fucking don't. No, you don't. You can be like, I don't want to deal with this. And it's like, maybe you risk certain people feeling alienated, but it's like, I think people underestimate how familiar people feel with celebrities because of social media, because of the world we live in. And if you want to recoil from that altogether, I think it makes perfect sense. And just because she's the only one speaking out about it, doesn't mean she's the only one who feels that way.
It's weird because I do think, you know, being able to deal with the public, you have to manage those interactions because you understand them better than this person who's really, really excited that they're getting to meet somebody from the other side of the screen, you know? But also, and I am, let's be fair, barely famous in any way. But years ago when I was on Chelsea Lately, I was at WeHo Starbucks, the one.
Yes.
The Leslie Jordan
Starbucks. Yes. Yes.
Openly weeping about a boy. Yeah. Openly weeping about a boy. And then somebody comes over and is like, guy, I love you on Chelsea Lately. Can we take a photo? And there's that interesting moment of like, do I take the photo with like snot coming out of my nose and my eyes all red and just sort of like have this moment, which is what I ended up doing, or do you say like, not right now?
But even the not right now can set people up.
Yes,
you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I just think like, again, I said when people go up to a celebrity, they feel like they don't know who I am. I'm going to change that. And also they think like if this doesn't go where I can lord it over them.
Well,
I think that's part of what they think.
I think it's hard. And I think it's really like setting into relief this moment of like, they're a big deal and I'm not. And if I can make them like me, if I can create an impression, good or bad, that sort of like puts me into the constellation with them. And I understand that instinct and inclination, but also like Chapel Roan has to lead a life. Mm-hmm. And I think our understanding and relationship of people who are particularly new to this, God, I'm worried for those heated rivalry boys.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
Like,
yes.
They have almost...
Get them actual Secret Service. Yes.
And they don't have a ton of money. Like they did a Crave Canada show.
Right.
All of the money that they have gotten has been from, like, upscale clothing brands having them put on their, you know, signature jock strap.
Yeah.
But like, I worry about... And everyone is treating them like they own them. And I really hope that they, having each other and having good, solid Canadians around them, will be able to manage them through this. But it does feel like dangerous territory.
I also just want to say, I want to specifically direct my keep it at this soccer guy.
Yeah.
It's like writing in all caps on social media at Chapel Roan, stay losing. Stay losing at everything you do. Like, you're not a fan of this woman, and yet you're like directing a mob at her because she didn't have precisely the interaction your daughter wanted to have with her. Fuck off.
Because this isn't an interaction between a random fan and Chapel Roan. It's an interaction between like a celebrity adjacent person not getting the thing that they want out of it.
Right. It's an ego hit for him.
Yeah.
Yes. That's part of what it is. Anyway, glad we settled that. I'm sure everyone will agree with me on social media. Can't wait to meet new friends.
Also, I just want to say, if I am weeping in public, come over. Let's talk about it.
You won't believe what I'm thinking about.
I mean,
it could be the 1980 Best Actress race.
But it's the thing about being our level of famous is that like, it's not meaning you can't get through the airport. And when somebody comes over, they probably do have a good story.
Well, also, I feel like for someone like you and me, again, whatever we are, like H minus, I don't know what number it is. But it's like people usually want to come up to me and talk about pop culture.
Right.
Which is different than like there's an aura about you and I just have to be in it, which is what these people have
you
to
wanna
deal
know
with.
What I'm already always ready for? What your book meant to me. Yeah. Like anytime anyone is like, I read your book, I'm like, so I guess I owe you 12 hours of community service because you spent 12 hours listening to my audiobook.
By the way, guy's book, if you've not read it, fabulous, My Life as a Goddess. When's the sequel, sweetie?
We're working on it, babe.
Okay. Oh, I love having a snotty interaction with you. That was almost Andy Cohen-ish. I enjoyed it.
Our greatest journalist.
Oh, no, I mean, he has a vibe where there are certain people, like Howard Stern, when celebrities sit across from them and then stories they've never brought up before just fall the fuck out.
He gets stuff out of people that no one else could. I want him to go back to his, like, Today Show roots and just do one political interview and then go back because, like, he really does, he understands.
Yeah, and he's always a fan but never impressed.
Yes.
I'm trying to discern what that energy is that gets those stories out of people.
Like, the thing is he's involved. He knows everything, but he's not he's not always charmed by it, or he's charmed by what he wants to be charmed by.
Right.
Like, I really do think that him getting the Housewives to Housewife on a Traitors reunion, while nobody else is very important.
No, I feel like Margaret Mead when I watch that shit. Yes. I'm like, what spider dance is happening here to make this occur? Anyway, we can dissect that some other time. Guy Branum, thank you so much, as always, for joining.
Thank you for having me.
Anything else you want to recommend right now, since you're chock full of recommendations these days?
Well, you know, my solo show, Be Fruitful, is going to be part of Netflix Is a Joke on May 9th. So if people want to get tickets for that, wouldn't it be nice to sell out? Wouldn't it be nice to tell the people at Netflix, Guy sells things out.
Yes. Okay, exactly. Me just mumbling that in my sleep. I would love to. Thank you for joining us. And thank you to the terrific Lisa Ann Walter for joining us as well. We will see you next week on Keep It. Don't forget to follow Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. You can also subscribe to Keep It on YouTube for access to full episodes and other exclusive content. And if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a review. Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our producer is Bill McGrath, and our executive producers are Louis Fertel, Ira Madison III, and Kendra James. Our digital team is Delon Villanueva, Claudia Shang, Rachel Gajewski, and Jay Banks. Thank you to David Tolles and Charlotte Landis for production support every week. Our head of production is Matt DeGroot. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.
Hey, so listen, whether you're in the States, across the pond, or somewhere on the other side of the world, we love that you tune into Crooked for US News. But did you know we also have a UK news show? Yes, that's right. It's called Pod Save the UK.
Pod Save the UK is a no bullshit, unabashedly progressive conversation about politics focused on the issues that matter most to the people of Britain. And with all the changes in our government, including the fun revolving door of prime ministers we have here, there's always lots to talk about.
And there's lots of fabulous guests to talk to, journalists, politicians, experts, comedians, and activists.
Yeah, we've had great comedians on as well, like Rosie Jones, Stuart Lee, Aisling B. We've also had Tommy Vietor on, who may be our boss.
We still don't know.
We're not quite clear on who our boss is. I thought it might be Tommy Vietor. I thought it might be Jon Favreau. I don't know if it's John Lovett. It's hard to say. It's not clear to us who our bosses are.
Some of our listeners call us irreverent but not stupid.
I object to that. I'm deeply
stupid.
It doesn't
sound too bad. So look, come check us out. Come join us. Pod Save the UK every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.